The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Had these little groups and these little groups, and eventually by 1796 you have I'm sorry, by 1816 you begin to have something to begin to form. You have something that forms, and I'll get to that in a minute. Now let's go to one other church here in Philadelphia, the Methodist Episcopal Church. Not all blacks who were in St. George's Church left with Richard Allen and Absalom Jones. You know, let's face it. I mean, you know, not all who were in the what was it called? Back in the 30s. You know the history when the Presbyterian Church went liberal and Machen and all those guys came out. What was the name of
the Great Separation.
What was the name of the church, the denomination, the Presbyterian Church in the U.S. or something? Was that the name of it?
Yeah.
Okay. So when when Machen and Van Til and all those guys and Schaefer and all those guys came out, right? Not all the Bible-believing people came out. Some of them stayed, right? And so it happened here. Same thing, same basic thing. So not all blacks who left, not all blacks left St. George's. But what happened in 1796 then, the Methodist Episcopal denomination founded Zor Methodist Episcopal Church, 1796. And this was a plantation church. And now, St. George's Church was a white church that a few blacks went to. But this became a plantation church, and guess what? Most of the remaining blacks in St. George's Church became a part of this church. Because, you know, they didn't want to be out of step with the times, you know. And so they left and became a part of that church. And check this out. Zor Methodist Episcopal Church was larger than Bethel AME Church until the 1820s. So though this was a movement that started and everybody was breaking out, you know, into these churches, at least in terms of the one church, Bethel AME Church, Zor Methodist Episcopal Church was larger than Bethel until the 1820s. Yeah. Zor, Z-O-A-R, Zor. All right. Now, as I said, these churches began to cooperate, and by 1816, you have the foundation of the African Methodist Episcopal denomination. On January 1, now they had been fighting this thing. They wanted to found their own denomination. The Methodist Episcopal Church said, you can't do it. It's illegitimate. Y'all can't do that kind of stuff, right? And they said, yes, we can. And so they went to court. And the court granted Bethel AME Church independence from the Methodist Episcopal denomination. And the AME Church started in the summer, or the AME denomination started in the summer of 1816. So finally, as I said, they thought of themselves as independent, and they finally got official independence in 1816. And guess who became the first bishop? Richard Allen. All right. It's 1816, the summer of 1816. Again, this is a movement that's starting all over. Peter Williams Sr., later on, pulled out of the John Street Methodist Church in New York City and founded Zion Church. And later, this became the African and Methodist Episcopal Zion denomination. Okay. Now here's where we started getting into interesting. Now in those early days, it was the Methodists who had most of the denominational stuff together here. Now, I'm going to read this to you, then I'm going to show it to you on a chart, so it'll make more sense to you. Okay. Are you ready for this? Now this is an interesting narration. Okay. Peter Spencer, in 1812, founded the Union American Methodist Episcopal Church in Wilmington, Delaware in 1812. All right? Now, he started the Union American Methodist Episcopal Church in 1812, Wilmington. Now, let's look at the later developments. Now, watch this. Now, I'm going to go through this. Like I said, I'm going to show you a chart, which would make more sense, but see if you can keep up with this. All right, later developments. In 1822, the Methodist Protestant Church split from the Methodist Episcopal Church and took their African American members with them. So there were still a few left. So now out from the Methodist Episcopal denomination comes the Methodist Protestant Church. Many African American Methodist Protestants pulled out of this denomination and formed the Colored Methodist Protestant Church. All right. In the 1860s, the Colored Methodist Protestant Church merged with Peter Spencer's Union American Methodist Episcopal Church, and they together became, are you ready for this? The Union American First Colored Methodist Protestant Church. Now I'm gonna make up a sweatshirt. You know, I belong to the Union American First Colored Methodist Protestant Church. Okay. Now, this denomination was just about as large as the AME and the AME Zion Church put together. It was a huge, huge denomination. But it functioned on congregational polity, all right? Now, during the stresses of the post-Reconstruction and the Industrial Revolution, many of these churches sought denominational protection, connection, and resources, but they weren't getting it because it was a congregational, in a congregational polity. Therefore, many left the Union American First Colored Methodist Protestant Church and joined the AME denomination and the AMEZ denomination. And what was left of the Union American First Colored Methodist Protestant Church split into two groups. Ready for this? The Union American Methodist Episcopal Church and the American Union Methodist Protestant Church. Okay, all right, now let's look at it on the chart here. Okay, I've got this chart that I put together just for y'all to show you how it works. All right, should have had this up and going already, but okay. All right, developments of some African American Methodist Episcopal churches. All right. Okay, here we go. All right, now remember, we go back to Peter Spencer's church, right? All right, Peter Spencer's church. He started the what? I want to make sure I get these names right. The Union American Methodist Episcopal Church, okay? Right? He starts the Union American Methodist Episcopal Church. Now, what happens is, you got the Methodist Episcopal Church, and out from that comes the what? The Union American, the Methodist Protestant Church. Okay, so the black members form the Methodist Protestant Church, now leaving the Methodist Episcopal Church almost all white now. Okay, all right. Now a split from that comes from then there's the Colored Methodist Protestant Church and the Methodist Protestant Church. All right. No, I'm sorry. I take that back. I got this wrong here. This church, this is a white denomination that split. That's right. This church split from the Methodist Episcopal. It took all the blacks with them, but it wasn't a black denomination. That's what it was. This then became all white. This denomination, then the blacks left it and became the Colored Methodist Protestant Church, and this became a white denomination. All right. Now, the Union American Methodist Episcopal Church then merges with the Colored Methodist Protestant Church to form what? Yeah, the Union American First Colored Methodist Protestant Church. Okay, all right. Now that became the largest black denomination for a while. Like I said, larger than, as large as the AME and the AME Zion put together. Now, remember they had polity. They had congregational polity, and the stresses of the what? Post-Reconstruction, and so forth and so on. They lost a lot of their churches because a lot of people then joined up with the AME and the AME Zion churches, okay, which diminished the roles of the Union American First Colored Methodist Protestant Church. Now, at the end of it, there was a split between these two, and the Union American Methodist, sorry about that, I went too far. The Union American Methodist Episcopal Church had its headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware, and the American Union Methodist Protestant Church had its headquarters, it'll catch up with us in a minute, had its headquarters in Norristown, Pennsylvania. All right, so here we go. And I think this will work now. I hope this works. Come on, come on, come on. I had to speed that up a little. There you go. Okay, so the Union American Methodist Episcopal Church, Wilmington, Delaware, and the American Union Methodist Protestant Church, Norristown, Pennsylvania. All right. And there are still remnants of those left today. But I found that to be very interesting. There was a lot of jostling and back and forth. Yes. The two, you see, what happened is that these guys were not, if they had Presbyterian form of government, they would have stayed together, I think, you know. But what they did, you know, since it was congregational and every church was autonomous, you know, the individual churches were, you know, under a lot of pressure and having a lot of problems. They were looking for some connection and protection and resources, and they weren't getting it. So these guys said, well, you know, come on over. We'll help you. You know, that's what happened. So they lost a lot of their churches to these historic, you know. And so eventually then each one of these became larger than this. And then in the final analysis, this split into these two groups. All right, that's what happened.
Is there significance to the fact that the name is American now and African as well?
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because you see, now you're beginning to deal with that's interesting, because you begin to, and later on you have the colored Methodist Episcopal Church starting. What began to happen was that these people, you see, you know, like anything, you have a movement, and you know, movements come and go, right? And not everybody, just like for example, okay, you take African Americans. Let's take African Americans in 1950, okay? Let's look at two possibilities here, okay? African Americans in 1950, you got two kind of folks in the subdominant culture. You got assimilational. And identificational. Okay, now you understand what I mean by those two, right? Assimilational, those who want to melt into the dominant culture, you know. You got identification of those who affirm their own culture. Well, in 1950, I'd say 80% of African Americans were assimilational. Okay? Today, of course, and 20% were identificational. Today, it's just the other way around. Okay? Most of us are identificational, and a few of us are assimilational. It ebbs and flows. Okay? Which brings me up to a whole other thing. You see, even in these days, you had African Americans. Some were identificational. They were African this and African that. And others who were saying, no, we're not African. We're just Americans, but we accept the term colored. Because colored was a less edgy word than Negro for many, not for everybody, but for many. Okay? All right. And so so that, you know, you have that, you know, you had and it ebbs and flows, and this is called what I call the AI ratio. Okay, the AI ratio, assimilational identificational ratio, and it changes from generation to generation. It changes from people group to people group. Okay, it changes, like, for example, let me give you one example here. You take, let's talk about, okay, let's talk about people of African descent, all right? African Americans, because we live here, and because we know, by the way, why did this thing shift? But let me, before I get to that, why did this thing shift? We were mostly assimilational back in 1950. Today we're mostly identical. Why did it shift? What happened? Civil rights? I don't think so, because civil rights movement facilitated assimilation. All right, I'll tell you what made it shift. No. If the dominant culture had accepted our sincere and fervent efforts at assimilation, it would have been over. But the dominant culture, no matter how hard we tried, we were still niggas. You got it? Get a PhD, you're still a nigga. You got it? And so, I mean, forgive me for using such a word, but I mean, I think that's appropriate in this particular case, right? Have you ever said Hebrew? Have you ever said Hebrew? Well, that was the equivalent term, you know. Remember in Egypt, remember, you know, when Joseph and Mrs. Potiphar tried to get, you know, him to cooperate? he leaves, and she said, "That Hebrew slave," and those, you know, that was a derogatory term, you know. And when Moses, God tells Moses to go to Pharaoh and say, "The God of the Hebrews has sent me." I got this directly from my Hebrew teacher, Dillard. All right, he says, God says, "Tell Pharaoh that the God of the Hebrews has sent me." Pharaoh gets a little militant. Moses gets a little militant. He says, "Yeah, Pharaoh, the God of Israel sent me." He said, "Who? Who are you talking about? I don't know who you're talking about." "The God of Israel. I don't know such a God. The God of the Hebrews." "Oh, okay. No, I know who you're talking about." Derogatory terms, see? So they were Hebrews then, right? But then that's a long span of time. In the early times when they were there, Joseph was a Hebrew. Latter times, they were Hebrews. But in between, when Pharaoh was so impressed by Joseph and Pharaoh invited his whole family to come to Egypt, guess what? They were no longer Hebrews, they were known as what? The children of Israel. Term of dignity. All right. So, you got it? So everybody, you know, everybody's got those derogatory terms. All right. Okay. Now, that's just off the subject here. Forgive me for jumping out. But that's what happened. It didn't work. Assimilation failed. And I might say, let me put a little caveat on this, all right? There's a whole lot of talk about reconciliation, and a lot of folks don't understand why it ain't working. Well. Why black folk ain't going for it, you know? Well, I'll tell you why. If there's a certain ministry that I really love, you know, it's a great, great ministry. I support them and all. But they have these rallies all over the country, you know? And it's the very first evangelical ministry that has put racism on the front burner, all right? And I love Coach. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that to come out. But anyway, and they say reconciliation. They come reconciliation. Now, if this thing had come out in 1950, you know, they would have been overrun by African Americans, right? But now they aren't. You know why? Because you see, we've moved beyond the reconciliation piece. We are now, if you really want to know, we're dealing with pre-reconciliational issues, things that have to happen before reconciliation can happen. Like, for example. All right, give me an example. All right, Zacchaeus, remember Zacchaeus, right? And you know the kind of setup he had in Jericho, right? Jericho used to be a nice neighborhood. Right now it's a ghetto, right? So how do you define a ghetto? A ghetto is where all the money goes out and doesn't come in. So there it was. Folks were kind of mad at Zacchaeus, right? Now what if Zacchaeus had come down? Let's change the text a little bit. What if Zacchaeus had come down out of the tree and faced the people of Jericho and said, "Can we all just get along?" What? You know, a riot would have broken out, right? Well, what does Zacchaeus do? See, he dismantles his criminal operation, in essence. You know what I'm saying? And he does restitution, and you know he does justice. That's a pre, and he does empowerment, by the way. He levels the playing field, a pre-reconciliational issue. All right. So we've gone beyond the point where we say, can we just get along? We need to deal with some issues of justice and empowerment and things like that. All right. So that's why. So the identificational piece, the reason that African Americans became identificational was because it's an empowerment issue. All right. So that's enough for the contemporary thing. So in those days, you had some of the same dynamics. That's the point I'm trying to make. You know, some African Americans were more assimilational, and therefore those tended to go by the colored thing. You know, they're not going to get into Africa because, after all, you know, Africa. That's Tarzan. You know, all those ignorant people in those movies. You know, you ever see Tarzan movies? Yeah. Would you want to be one of those kind of folk? Okay. All right. Of course, I know they didn't have movies in those days, but I'm just saying, figuratively speaking. I mean, you know, there was this propaganda that Africa was this terrible place, you know. And it's true that today Africa isn't a pretty picture. But oh, here's what I wanted to say. This is the other thing I wanted to say. That's right. Let's take peoples of Africa to sin. I didn't finish that thought. And this is true among any people group who are in a country like this, who have a contingent of people here. And all right, now. Most Africans that I encounter here in this country are immigrants. And immigrants, when they come to another country, this is just, again, one of these axiom kind of things. Immigrants tend to be much more assimilational than the indigenous people of that same group are. All right? Because you see, they're assimilating. It's a whole nother culture. It's a whole nother culture, and you're trying to get along. You know, you're trying to figure out how to make it. And and if you're going to make it in the culture, if you got to conform, you got to conform. If you come over here, you got to assimilate into some kind of a culture. You know what I'm saying? Unless you have this huge number of people from your city or something. You know, whatever. But you got to assimilate into some kind of a culture. So which one are you going to choose? You can choose the dominant culture or the subdominant culture if you really want to make it in that society. You can choose the dominant culture to assimilate to, all right? So Africans who are immigrants tend to, there are exceptions, but they tend to be more, they have a different AI ratio than African Americans. The assimilational thing is higher because they're immigrants. Because the dynamic is that they are immigrants. It's not that they are, you know, less caring as people. And so in a lot of institutions such as Westminster, okay, you know, or a lot of Christian colleges, I'll ask and say, yeah, blah, 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 blah. How many blacks do you have on campus? Oh, we got 35. Great. How many of them from America? Let's see. Well, we had one 3 years ago, and what's that all about? See, they preferred the Africans. Why? Because they were much more willing to assimilate. And institutions, especially Christian institutions, do not tolerate people who would tend to upset the status quo. And this is just a human thing, you know. So that, therefore, we, you know, an institution such as this would tend to gravitate more towards assimilational people. And I'll go on to make this point too. Okay, and again, I just forgive me for taking these sidelines, but these are some of the dynamics. This is useful stuff because these are some of the dynamics behind why the African American Church came about. If you are, say, an institution such as Westminster. I'll just talk about Westminster. I mean, I've been in other institutions, but I'll talk about Westminster. You've got, let's talk about the window. I have a window of dominant cultural response. Okay, you have identificational, assimilational, you got hard, and you got soft assimilation, you know, soft ones, you know, who are kind of laid back. You got hard ones, okay? All right. The hard ones are militant in their approach. The soft ones are laid back in their approach. An institution such as Westminster, all right, this is something for you to understand, and this is something, again, and I'm going to share this with you because I'm hoping that y'all being here could maybe help this school. And I'm on the board. I'm trying to help it from my point of view, but I'm hoping that you can help. And this would go for anybody. This is general principle. There is a place, if I come here as an identificationalist, okay, for example, in a school like Westminster. Now, Westminster says it's interested in diversity, all right? So I'll just take their word for it, all right? All right. There's an interest in, so we're talking about a dominant cultural institution that is interested in diversity, all right? There is a sweet spot. If you're part of the subdominant culture, there is a sweet spot to be in. And that would be to be, here's a sweet spot. In other words, this is the place of least difficulty, to be a soft assimilationalist. You will have less trouble in this institution if you are a soft assimilationist, if you're from any subdominant culture, all right? If you're a hard assimilationalist, one of these, you know, TR guys in the you know, if I'm a black TR guy, you know, if you understand, swallowing the whole cultural bit and all that, I'm gonna have some difficulty here, some difficulty here. If I'm a soft assimilation, a soft identificationist, I'm gonna have some difficulty. But if I'm a hard identificationist, I'm gonna have trauma. So the dynamics of Westminster and the dynamics of other institutions such as Westminster that are dominant cultural, that are interested in diversity, the dynamics, the forces, if you don't watch it out, it's gonna drive you to be a soft assimilationalist. Okay? And if that's not where you're coming from, then you're gonna have difficulty or trauma. Does that make sense? Okay, which brings me all the way back to, and I bring all this up to, which brings me all the way back to, these are some of the dynamics that were operating in these early churches. See, there were some identificational folks, but they had to be quiet and all that because they were in this white denominational thing, right? They got tired of it and they just broke off and started their own things. So it wasn't an issue of racism or anything like that. It was an issue of trauma, actually, and difficulty. Does that make sense? Okay, yeah, so those are some of the dynamics that are in operation. So a lot of times when I get off into a tangent, there's a madness to my method. There's a, what if I just say that? Whatever, you know what I'm saying. There's a something, you know, something about madness and method. You put it together. But what I'm identifying to you are the actual dynamics at work that were at work in those days and that are still at work today. Now I saw a hand somewhere, yes.
You know, being a member of, I guess, what you're calling the dominant culture of Westminster, if I'm in that bottom left-hand corner quadrant, I'm going to run into the same issues that someone from a different culture is going to run into.
If you're a soft assimilationist?
I'm sorry, in the right-hand corner.
Over here?
If I'm...
Oh, yeah.
Whichever corner you're sitting.
Yeah, you're going to have some difficulty. Yeah, even if you're in the dominant culture here.
So I get... Is it as much cultural, or is it? I mean, it seems like the ideal student that Westminster would want from any culture is the one who's going to be assimilational.
Westminster should be set up so that nobody. Well, I have my problems with these folk, okay, but I'm just going to say, you know, I got to love everybody, all right. I have my prejudices too, okay. But I'm going to say Westminster should be such an institution, if we're really Christian, that none of these people would feel trauma or difficulty. That this would be a place where we can get theological education and exchange ideas. You know what I'm saying? So that's ideally speaking. I like to see that happen. So nobody should have difficulty because of their stance in the AI ratio. All right? All right. Okay. Does that? Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, I'm talking about subdominant culture here. I'm talking about subdominant culture. Dominant culture will be slightly different, but I tell you one thing: if you came here as a hard-edged theonomist, you'd have some difficulty. I don't care who you are. You know what I'm saying? Is that right? I hope that's right.
Yes.
If I were here, I'd help to give you some difficulty. See, that's my prejudice. Okay, Okay, all right. But you see what I'm saying. I mean, but generally I'm speaking here about from the subdominant point of view, all right? And the people who have least difficulty, the people in the subdominant cultures, however you want to define those, who have least difficulty here in this institution, I can guarantee you are soft assimilationalists.
Maybe my question is, and I know this is not a naive question, because I'm aware of man's sin, but is subdominant culture and dominant culture, I mean, if we really are really desirous of being multicultural in the biblical sense,
we should, yeah.
Is that really a gospel category that we ought to even be thinking in? That, I mean, or ought we be thinking of what's biblical?
It should not be a church behavioral category. But it is a category when it comes to considering how we preach the gospel, because that's a reality out there. All right. That's you know, you got to preach the gospel to the issues that are out there. And you have dominance and subdominance. That's, you know, and again, remember, you have dominance plus sin, you have oppression. Just plain and simple, you know. I mean, look, I don't have to be a racist to be an oppressor. I used to do my daughter's hair, you know. I do my daughter's hair all the time, you know. When she was first born, that's what I said to her. I tell her this all the time. I was hoping it was going to be a boy, because I already had a boy. Now, I love little girls, don't get me wrong, but I already had a boy, and I kind of had that figured out, see. Plus, I had some clothes that I got for him when he was little, you know, and it was too big for him. By the time I got him home, he was too small for them. You know how that is with little infants, you know. If you ever have little babies, don't save the clothes. If somebody gives you a beautiful evening gown for your little 2-day-old infant, let her wear it right then and get it messed up, because that's the only time she'll wear it. Next time you get around to it, she'll be too big for it. Okay, but I knew it. But I, you know, and when she was born, I said, oh boy, it's a girl. Hey, praise God. But oh no, I'm gonna have to do that hair. Oh, and I don't know anything about doing hair. And sure enough, I started doing her hair. And actually, I kind of started liking it. I got pretty good at it, you know. Anyway, one day I was doing her hair, and I used to make it look, I was good at it. I mean, I'm gonna tell you, I was good. Overhand braids, underhand braids, I mean, I had the whole thing together, right? So one day, being her father, I'm in a dominant position over her, right? So I did her hair, it was looking real pretty. She says, Daddy, it hurts, because I had it too tight. And what was my response? Oh, Nikki, it doesn't hurt. Now what's happening? Because something came up in her reality that was totally off my radar screen. I wasn't my intention to put any pain on her, you know. It was off my radar screen. So because I'm in the dominant position, I define the situation in such a way that her pain didn't exist. So I denied her reality. Oh, it doesn't hurt, Nikki. She said, but it hurts. I said, no, it doesn't hurt. Come on, this is. And then she started crying. And then I realized, oh my gosh, what have I done? I just oppressed my daughter, you know. So I loosened it up and didn't look quite as good, but at least, you know. You know, so you know, because see, I had a dominant position, and I denied her reality. That was sin, see, and so I oppressed her. You know, so you know, it can happen. You know, it. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to give you the actual, what is actually going on, in terms of the universal human condition. Now, once we understand that, then we see its manifestation in the American situation. But if you go to Kenya today, we can talk about the same stuff. Then we're talking about the Kikuyus versus all the other tribes in Kenya. You got me? And everybody over there is black, you know. But it's the same thing. It's the same thing. Yes.
How did African Americans
see Africans to assimilate? Well, how do African Americans see Africans to assimilate? Well, you know, any group of people who are from I'll talk about African Americans. We've had kind of a love-hate relationship with Africa. You know, there was a time when we were ashamed of our African heritage. I mean, you know, I'm gonna tell you straight up. I mean, go back to 1950s. You talk to any African American about his family tree, he'll tell you about his Indian ancestors. He'll tell you about his European ancestors. You know, he won't tell you about his African ancestors. Hello. I mean, that's today it's different, all right? All right. Back in those days, we were ashamed of Africa. We thought it was a terrible place and all that kind of stuff. Then all of a sudden, the 60s come, the Black Consciousness Movement come. Everybody idealizes Africa. Africa's the motherland. It's the I Ching of all, you know. Okay. Okay, so there's this idealization. And see, a lot of African Americans went back to Africa, right? You see, yeah, yeah, I'm going home. I'm going to the motherland. They get off the plane. Yeah, I'm home. I'm African. And a lot of Africans burst their bubble with one question. You know what that one question was? Oh, you're African, huh? What tribe are you from? Okay. So there is a the way we tend to think of Africa now as African Americans is not actually the way it necessarily is. All right, it's funny whenever I go to Africa, I say, yeah, you know, I kind of feel that too. Yeah, I'm kind of home. I'm home, you know. And the Africans say, oh, you're home, huh? Well, let me replace you in America. You stay here, you know. But I think there is a kind of an expectation on the parts of some of us that Africans will be just as identificational, that Africans will be Afrocentric, like we are. And can we talk? All right. I have yet to meet, I'm not saying they don't exist, but I have yet to meet an Afrocentric African. Never met one. All right. Yeah, we all have something that all of it revolves around. And what is that? It's either tribe. It's probably more tribal-centric, you know, than Afrocentric. So I think in terms of Africa, my African friends think in terms of their tribe or their whatever, their family or whatever. And so there's an expectation on the part of a lot of us that Africans will think it's just as Afrocentric as we do. So I think there's disappointment there. And sometimes there's misunderstanding. But generally speaking, I think if we understand that, I mean, for example, I have a friend who's Kikuyu. She's from Kenya. And I, you know, when she first came to the States, you know, we you know, I have a thing about Africa, right? So, I, you know, we became friends and we got to talking, but every time we talk, we end up in these arguments. You know, how can you think that? I said, how could she think that way? You know, she's thinking white. I couldn't figure it out. How could an African think white? You know, that doesn't make any sense. And then one day I went to Kenya and I started asking around about, you know, some things. And by this time I started understanding this dominant, subdominant stuff, and I discovered that the Kikuyus were the dominant tribe. So I said, oh. So I came back and said, Esther. I said, are you Kikuyu? She said, how did you know? I said, oh, well, now I understand. She was thinking in terms of dominant culture, you know. That's why I said she was thinking white. So I said, look, I sat her down. I said, here's the deal. And I showed her some of this. She said, oh, she said, because I was wondering where you were coming from. You know, she was thinking, I guess she expected me to be thinking like her, being a Kikuyu. And so then, you know, now we don't have any arguments. She understands, we understand, you know. And she, oh, she's now thinking in terms of the subdominant culture, by the way. I gotta say. Okay. but there was a disappointment that I felt because she wasn't thinking. I expected her to think the way I was thinking, and we all do that, don't we? You know, but I think if and this goes with Africans and African Americans. This goes for, I guess, I got to know a lot of Chinese Americans, and of course there's this big thing. I don't know if it's going on today, but like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, there was this big thing going on between the ABCs and the OBCs. You know, there was just, you know. American-born Chinese and overseas-born Chinese. I mean, you know, there was a lot of tension going on, and people just weren't understanding each other, you know. And again, it had something to do with this stuff. You know, the ABCs were very assimilational, and the OBCs were very identificational, you know, because they remembered back home, you know. And there was this, you know. And so it's a universal thing. It's always the case. So I think what we need to do we need to understand that. I mean, if I'm going to go over to Tasmania, all right, and I know I got to live in Tasmania for the rest of my life, you know, I'm gonna figure out how to make it in Tasmania. I'm gonna do whatever I have to do to make it, you know, and the culture that I would tend to, just in terms of my own personal well-being, the culture I tend to identify with would be the dominant culture. But me, in terms of who I am right now. In terms of my attitude, I'm not going to just think in terms of my own personal welfare. I'm going to think in terms of people I identify with. My people are oppressed people, All right. So I tend to identify with the oppressed. So I tend to identify and even, you know, assimilate even into at least culturally with the whoever the oppressed peoples are. That would be my tendency now, because but in terms of my own personal well-being and material stuff, I would tend to assimilate to the dominant culture. That's just a human thing. All right. All right. All right. All right. So here we ended up with the American Union Methodist Protestant Church. Protestant Church. Okay. All right. I'm almost finished. We're getting ready to take a break here. Many independent Baptist churches were founded during this period. Okay. So we got these AME type churches, the Methodist Episcopal type churches, but many independent Baptist churches were founded during this period in states like Maryland, Georgia, Virginia, Kentucky, northern cities such as New York, Boston, and Philadelphia. So again, you have this indigenous phase, and you have independent Baptist churches being founded. And there were a few denominational African American churches founded during this period, and of course I've already mentioned those, like the First and Second African Presbyterian churches. Today, by the way, the Second African Presbyterian Church is now known as the Lombard Presbyterian Church. Is it still down there? The Lombard Presbyterian Church is now known as the Lombard Pres. As a matter of fact, when I lived here in Philadelphia, one of my distant relative, her father went to the First African Presbyterian Church. That's interesting. Okay, and then there were a few other denominational churches, such as Episcopal churches, Congregational churches, and eventually blacks began to come back into the Methodist Episcopal denomination. Okay, you know, because you had black churches being formed, you know, like the PCA and like the OPC. Are there any African-American OPC churches? I'm sure there are. One or two? I don't know. But blacks began to come back into the Methodist Episcopal Church in terms of congregations. And later on, in 1844, the Methodist Episcopal Church split over slavery. And you had the Methodist Episcopal Church in the North, and the Methodist Episcopal Church in the South. And several of the African American churches remained in the Methodist Episcopal denomination, and I might say that later on, they remained in the one in the North. Okay, later on, I'm sorry, in the South. Later on, the African American churches were allowed to form their own denomination called the Colored Methodist Episcopal Church. Okay, so that's it on that. Those are the phases of the church. So we have, what are the phases now? The peanut gallery phase, plantation, and indigenous. Okay. All right. So let's take a break, and then we'll come back. We'll come back for part two for today. PC mute. Okay. All right. Oh, I didn't know I was that boring, man. Yeah, video. Yeah, you have to get the, yeah, right. Okay, all right, so where are we? We left off talking about the three phases of the African American church. Okay, now we want to look at the African American church in the antebellum North. Now, we looked at the antebellum South. We want to look at the African American church in the antebellum North, okay? Or shall we say theological development in the antebellum North. Okay, so what was the cultural situation in the North before the Civil War? First of all, Philadelphia became the hotbed of post-slavery theology. All right? This is a real historic place we're in here, okay? And why was Philadelphia the hotbed? Because it was the major terminus of the Underground Railroad. And because it was a major hub, the northern became the headquarters, as it were, of antebellum northern theological thinking. All right. Now, let's talk about this development of the Northern theology. Now, we talked about the Southern theology. Remember we said it was a theology. Remember when theology emerges among a people, what the interaction between the Bible, the biblical truth and the situation produces what? Praxis, remember that? And praxis is putting into reality according to our life theme, right? All right. Now, what was the praxis in the South? It was a theology of what? Suffering. What was the paradigm? It was in the biblical, the Exodus. All right. So now we go up north. In the northern situation, you didn't have a theology of suffering as much as you had a theology of what? Empowerment. Because you see, what was the core issue up north? See, in the South, the issue was slavery. All right? In the North, the issue was marginalization. Marginalization. You know what I mean by marginalization, right? All right. Okay. So the brothers and sisters up north they developed a theology of empowerment, because marginalization is nullified by empowerment. All right. So that was the thing. So you had a distinct difference between the Northern and the Southern African-American theology. There were two African-American theologies, as it were. Okay, now, the biblical paradigm now. Okay, any theology that emerges among a people, in order for it to really communicate, must have a biblical paradigm. What do you think the biblical paradigm was? Not the Exodus, but the what? Can anybody guess?
The Promised Land,
Nehemiah. I think it has something to do with Nehemiah. Something that was going on during the time of Nehemiah.
The exile,
that's right. So the biblical paradigm, it was in the exilic paradigm. So the Northern African American theology was in the exilic paradigm. All right, so now that we got a biblical paradigm, what were the cultural core issues? Remember, we talked about cultural core issues last night. Remember? The cultural core issues. The cultural core issues that this theology dealt with how you get saved and all that. You know what I'm saying? This is a salvific aspect. But I'm talking about the communication aspect now. How it related to the people. How, in which way did we communicate it? What were the cultural core issues that this Northern theology dealt with? Here they were. Dignity, or human dignity. All right. We already got a hint of one of them already. Another one, we've alluded to it. African identity. Remember? Afrocentrism, remember, was originally a Christian concept. African identity. And the third one, which is one that other groups have dealt with, the divine significance of the African American experience. Those were the cultural core issues that the Northern theology addressed. The divine significance of the African American experience. Now, in other words, that third one is trying to answer the question, why are we here? See? Now, that was a question asked by Joseph. That was a question asked by the people of Judah when they were in Babylon. Why are we here? What for? What purpose? It's got to have some divine significance, all right? And I might add that out of that question emerged Pan-Africanism. You've heard of Pan-Africanism? It was originally a Christian concept. Because it was up in the north that they began to talk about saying things like, we are part of the African diaspora. See, the exilic paradigm. The African diaspora. We're part of the African diaspora. And we have a special role to play in that African diaspora. And when they talked about the African diaspora, they're talking about peoples of African descent living in the south, in the north, in Canada, in Africa, obviously, in the Caribbean, and in South America. All right, and wherever else they may be. Okay, so those are the that pretty much. Now I remember about 4 years ago, I got a king size bed that often becomes my desk. You know, I had these papers and this and articles and this, so forth and so on, some all lined up. You know, I said there's something. There's kind of a thread that's running between all this stuff. I said, what is it? What is it? And it finally hit me. It was these two theologies, the Southern theology of suffering, the Northern theology of empowerment. Okay, now let's look at some factors that led up to the development of this sense of exilic theological empowerment. Now, I'm going to give you a quote, and I want you to tell me, this is a paraphrase of the quote, I want you to tell me who said this. We want freedom in this society, at this time, right now, by any means necessary. Who said that? Malcolm X. And we all say that, okay, we say that he was, but actually he wasn't the first one to say that. All right. Now, let's look at some of the theologians of the antebellum North. Now, we say that Malcolm said that, and he did say that, but he wasn't the first one to say that. That's right. Okay, let's look at some of the theologians of the antebellum North. All right, now the first one, I don't know if this name rings a bell to you, but his name is what? I think it comes up here automatically. Henry Highland Garnett. Does that ring a bell? Reverend Henry Highland Garnett. All right, Henry Highland Garnett. Okay, so who was he? He was born a slave in Kent County, Maryland. Okay. He escaped from slavery in 1824. Yeah, that's in 1824. He studied theology at a media institute in Utica, New York, and became a pastor. And he served as president of Avery College in Allegheny, Pennsylvania. Now, you will find, you wonder, where do you get this Northern theology? Where do you find it? Okay, now the Southern theology, where do you find it? You find it in the oral tradition. You can pick it out, okay? Now, in the Northern theology, where do you find it? Not in books, but see what they would do, what they did in the North, they had all these conventions. They were always having some kind of convention of this and that and the other. And you will find this Northern expressions of this Northern antebellum theology in the speeches that were given at these conventions in the North. If you read those records, you begin to pick out some things. Oh yeah, by the way, various places. Library of Congress is a good place to go, and you start looking. You get one of them, and then you get a book on that, and then it'll tell you about another one. You just got to run the references, that's all. Okay. So, he had a very interesting address to the National Convention of Colored Citizens of Buffalo, New York, 1843. Reverend Henry Highland Garnett, Presbyterian minister, hello, into Reformed theology, all right. And in those days, you know, you didn't have liberalism, you know what I'm saying, in the way we have it today. So let's look at what he had to say. Now, he's addressing this convention, but in addressing this convention, he was actually, he knew that his words would be carried over and over and over again and would get into the South. So he's addressing the convention, but he's actually speaking to slaves. All right? And you don't have to get this whole quote, but here it goes. In every man's mind, the good seeds of liberty are planted. And he who brings his fellow down so low as to make him content with his condition of slavery commits the highest crime against God and man. To such degradation, it is sinful in the extreme to make voluntary submission. The divine commandment you are duty bound to reverence and obey. If you do not obey them, you will surely meet with the displeasure of the Almighty. Your condition does not absolve you from your moral obligation. The diabolical injustices by which your liberties have been cloven down, neither God nor angels or just men command you to suffer for a single moment. Therefore, it is your duty to use every means, both moral, intellectual, and physical, that promotes success. Brethren, arise, arise, strike for your lives and liberties. Now is the day and the hour. Let every slave throughout the land do this, and the days of slavery are numbered. You cannot be more oppressed than you have been. You cannot suffer great cruelties than you have already. Rather die as freedmen than live as slaves. Let your motto be resistance, resistance, resistance. No oppressed people has ever secured their liberty without resistance. That's Henry Highland Garnett, 1843. This guy could run rings around Malcolm X. All right, that's Henry Highland Garnett. You may not agree, but that's what he had to say, and that was one of the contributing factors to this Northern theology of empowerment. Now, there was another contributing factor to this, a guy named Samuel Hopkins, and he had some views that said something to this effect. Assisting the nations to come to the knowledge of the truth is to contribute to the alleviation of human suffering. All right? And he also said to promote world missions is a sign of true holiness. Now, going back to that question, the divine significance of the African-American experience, why are we here? There were a lot of thinkers in those days that began to understand that our reasons for being in America were parallel to the reasons why Joseph was in Egypt. Okay? And parallel to the reasons for why Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were in Babylon. All right. All right. Now, he called this thing, so missions became the primary thing. Now, remember I said Pan-Africanism, remember? The whole idea was the African diaspora, we had a special obligation to take the gospel of Jesus Christ to the rest of the African diaspora. And according to Samuel Hopkins, to promote world missions is a sign of true holiness. It is to contribute to the alleviation of human suffering. All right. He called this disinterested benevolence. Disinterested benevolence. To be willing to suffer one degree of pain and misery in order to save another from 100 degrees of pain. You got it? So it's I'm willing to suffer to bring alleviation to someone. And another concept that emerged during this time, and it's a biblical concept, I labeled the concept. It's not labeled this way in the history books, but I call it kinship compassion. That's the best way to sum it up. The special kinship relationship many Northern African Americans felt towards Africa and people of African descent. Okay. This was a major factor which led to the emergence of the black nationalist immigrationalist movement in the 1840s and 50s. Now, believe it or not, you know, you hear about Marcus Garvey, right? You know, you've heard of him, right? Marcus Garvey, this back to Africa thing. But in the 1840s and 50s, there was another back to Africa movement. And during those days, whole churches, you know, pastors were trained to be sea captains, and whole churches picked up and left and went to Africa and planted themselves there, you know. This was a form of missions, but it was never recorded, it was never recognized as such by those who officially record missionary history. All right. So that's kind of what was happening. And there were people going, and these were pretty straight people. These weren't people who had a little wacky quirks in their doctrine like Marcus Garvey did. I mean, Marcus Garvey, you know, had some good things going, but there were some quirks in his doctrine. These people were pretty straight. All right. So this movement advocated the immigration, as I said, of select African Americans to Africa or the Caribbean. Now let's go to another one of these, theologians of the African American theologians of the antebellum North.